The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
And good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to my Saturday afternoon show on this fine September 14th, 2013. The topic today is more on the... I still don't have my voice. Here it comes. Finally came up. The topic today is more on the White Rose Society, which I talked about on Monday, September 10th, on the Heretics Hour, but just made a start, as it turned out, in the importance that Christian religious convictions played in the minds of the members of that small resistance group. I didn't quite grasp that importance at the time, but I found the stories of these young people to be very interesting. So I'll also bring in, for the first time, the so-called table talks of Adolf Hitler and his controversial or notorious, you might, if to some people, remarks about Christianity. I've stayed away from table talks because I had ideas about its lack of authenticity, only in the English translation with the introduction by Trevor Roper. But people have told me that's not the case, that there's nothing wrong with it, and I've gotten enough information from people along those lines that I've decided to take, you know, to drop my resistance to it and go ahead and use it. I'm going to be using that for this program, but I probably won't come until the second hour. I might mention it a few times. I don't know exactly how that will go. But concerning, concerning that same program of September 10th, I received an email from a regular listener and contributor who was appalled at my pronunciation of Rudolf Huss. I was pronouncing it at the time as Huss because I thought, I just decided to do that because I thought I wasn't sure about how it really should be or that I would be able to continue to say it right if I tried something different. And then people also sometimes don't know who you're talking about. You know, if a lot of people, if you say Rudolf Huss's name correctly, they think you're talking about Rudolf Hess. So when you're talking to a predominantly English-speaking audience that doesn't speak German, you have to consider that. This person was trying to give me a lesson in how to pronounce that. They wrote a bunch of stuff which I already knew in writing. It's just a matter of being able to do it in practice. So it wasn't that I needed that particular lesson, but it did prompt me to ask about the pronunciation. And I did find out that it can be very simple, that it is, according to one source, as I just was saying it, Huss. It's not anything difficult to say, as in Huss, H-O-E-S-S. Or the O with the umlaut. Now that transfer, I think I can do that fine. And that's how I'm going to pronounce it from now on. But it is close to Hess. And also, this transfers over to Goebbels and Goering also, which people have a hard time with, and understandably so. And it's very common for English speakers to pronounce it as Goebbels, and you get carried away, and pretty soon you're sounding very English. There's no German to it. It's Goebbels, like a gerbil. But I've been saying Goebbels just to stay away from the Goebbels, but now I have to use that sound, and it is simply Goebbels. Now that sounds kind of funny to us, Goebbels. It doesn't sound very good. People, I think, don't like to say it, but I didn't. At first I said Goebbels, you know, but I've gotten used to it. So that's why I'm going to be pronouncing that. if I can remember, and then Goering, just plain Goering. Goering. That's all I have to say is Goering. Don't have to make it all fancy or anything. And it's really not hard when according to this way. And it is the problem for me is in switching my thinking as I'm talking away in English to pronouncing this one word in a German way, which is not common in the English language. So it's not, it's not a part of the way my mouth is moving or my tongue or my mind is thinking at all. And all of a sudden I have to do that. I'm not good at switching. Some people are good or better than me at switching from back and forth from one thing to another, but I'm not. I know that about myself. So that's why it's been so difficult for me. But I think I've got a handle on some of this. So I do thank that person who wrote to me and pointed that out. I always appreciate the information and even complaints and criticisms and lessons and so on that I get from readers, even if it might strike me not so great right the first time I see it. I do. I usually do something about it, and then I'm better for it. So I, keep all that coming. Now, the question for today's program is, if it is in the final analysis, that is Christianity inimical or incompatible, we might say, to National Socialism and Hitler's Third Reich? Now, amongst those of us who are interested in this, many, there's people on both sides, people who insist it's absolutely incompatible, and those who insist that it is very compatible. And we know who those people are for the most part. And if this even existed during the time of the Third Reich, that this same difference of opinion was going on. So this is what what we're keeping in mind here as we look at this. And according to the White Rose Society and their friends and supporters, it was incompatible to National Socialism. They liked Christianity, or something close to it, and they did not like National Socialism, and they thought that they were incompatible. And their concern was for Christian values, for practicing their Christian values was paramount, as we're going to find. So the general explanation for this society, White Rose, is that in the early summer of 1942, and I would encourage anybody who did, I don't know how important it is, but you could just remind you once again that I did talk about this some on September 10th on Heretics Hour, but not all that long. And this is a I'm attempting here to just go on from there and not repeat what I already said there. So, but I'm repeating here that in the summer of 1942, Hans Scholl, spelled S-C-H-O-L-L, and Alexander Schmorell, spelled S-C-H-M-O-R-E-L-L, co-authored 6 anti-Nazi Third Reich political resistance leaflets. They're also called pamphlets because they're not just, some leaflet with a little few words on it. They're fairly involved essays, you might say. and as far as is known, because this is all the information that I've been able to see about who wrote them, Hans Scholl wrote the first and the fourth leaflets, and Alex Schmorell wrote the second and third ones. And George Wittgenstein, whose memoir about the time I was reading and relying on the Heretics Hour program, he was another member, he edited the third and fourth leaflets. He didn't write anything. And mostly everything was written by Hans Scholl and Alex Schmorell. Professor Karl Huber, who they were associated with at the University of Munich, wrote the fifth one, and supposedly at the request of Hans, who asked him to do it. And then the sixth one was the final one that was distributed, and it's not said who wrote it. I couldn't find that out. I'm going to be reading the third one later on, after I finish all this information I've got here, which was written by Shmorel, the Russian. I call him the Russian, and you'll see why after I talk about him. I read the first one on Monday, and it was by Shmorel. I didn't read the whole thing, but I read part of it and talked about what was in the rest of it because I was running out of time. And it sounded, I commented at the time that it sounded very much like Soviet propaganda. And that was before I knew as much as I know now. That was the first one. And then the third one, I'm going to read too, because I think it's very, very, it's the most interesting, most revealing, I thought. And it was happened to also be written by Shmorel. I'm sorry, I got to clear my throat for a minute. I just finished eating, and so I'm a little, it always happens to me. Calling themselves, to continue here, calling themselves the White Rose, the pamphlet leaflets instructed Germans to passively resist the Nazis, says one site. But no, that's not right. They didn't call for passive resistance. They called for active resistance. The explanation is always given that the group had been horrified by the behavior of some German soldiers on the Eastern Front, where they had witnessed cruelty toward Jews in Poland and Russia. And see, that we're going to find that is one of the main causes of dissent amongst this group, the cruelty to Jews, how the Jews were treated. These particular Christian people could not tolerate, could not accept that. Although all kinds of Christians in Germany did. But these particular people were more serious and more committed and more, and more involved in all that was being, all other elements, I should say, of the resistance. So, let me just go right in here to talking first about Hans Scholl. And I'm going to actually just read this thing from a website called www.katjasdasha.com. It's spelled katjasdasha.com. And it's, it's not all about the White Rose, but she's written about it. And after reading other things about Hans Scholl, and then along with this, I thought that this gave all the facts the way everybody else does, but also has had a certain, tone to it that I think is kind of important. And as you can tell from her name, Katja, she's an American woman born in America, but she's obviously seems to be of Russian descent, and therefore is... has her natural preference for that country. And so she has written about, she's been very interested in the White Rose Society and also in Alex Shmorel. But here she's writing, she's got a page on Hans Scholl. She says, if there was any true leader of the White Rose, it would have been Hans Scholl. It was Hans Scholl and Alexander Shmorel who thought up the White Rose in the first place. Many of the people involved in the White Rose were involved through Hans Scholl, whether it was through friendship, recruitment, or carelessness, as could be said in the event of his sister's involvement. Hans Scholl was a second child and the first son born to Robert and Magdalena Scholl. The Scholl household was different in many ways, first of which was the fact that Magdalena Scholl was 10 years older than her husband. Now, this is the Scholl kids' parents. I've got a little note here because I'm saying I wonder if she was a cougar who got her fangs into poor Robert, Katana? I'm having a, there's been a little comment exchange between Katana and I since the program, on the program page about the David Irving. When I was talking about David Irving, And we've gotten into this thing about women and women who are older, who get younger women to marry them as though they're, you know, out to get it. But there's so many of that. There's so much of that, that it's just kind of ridiculous to me to make a case out of that. So in this case, these good Christian folks, this Robert somehow married a woman who was 10 years older than him, and they had quite a few children. Secondly, Robert Scholl, the father, was involved in politics well before the time of Hitler. And I'm saying, yeah, he obviously was a social democrat and was pro-Weimar. He was active, you know, pre-Hitler and opposed to Hitler, along with all the social democrats. And we find out that he was something of a politician as well. And it says that the results of elections, this woman writes, and such precipitated moves on the part of the Scholl family at a time when most German families stayed in one place for generations. And the fact is, yeah, they moved several times while their children were growing up. The reasons always seem to be something to do with politics. And Eng, the oldest daughter, and Hans Scholl were both born in Engersheim, but the family moved to Forchtenberg in 1919 as Robert Scholl, the father, remember, was elected mayor of the town. And as it was there that the other Scholl children, Elizabeth, Sophie, Werner, and baby Tilda, or Hilda, really, were born. Hilde. Times were tough, but the Scholls had it better than most. Robert Scholl was employed, and he earned enough money that they didn't starve. Okay, well, there were people starving, Germans starving then. Although they still had to be extremely careful when spending money, there was enough to take care of the children and to hire two maids to help take care of the household. Well, in those days when you had five children, although the fifth one didn't survive, though I don't know when it died exactly in this, when they had these maids, but you know, you do need some help for sure. In 1929, however, the U.S. stock market crashed, causing a worldwide economic depression. For Forchtenberg, the town that they were living in then, and Robert was the mayor, he was up for re-election, but he lost. So he was able to find a job in Stuttgart. They moved there. Then they moved to Ludwigsburg, which was close to Stuttgart and could be reached by train. And during this time, Father Robert was taking courses after work in order to become a business and tax consultant. Although he wasn't particularly happy with this, with the Nazis winning more elections in Germany, he probably knew his days as a politician were over if they came into power. This is what is written on this website. In 1932, he found a job in Ulm, and so the family moved once again. So Robert Scholl and his wife, probably along with him, were definitely members of the Social Democrats who vehemently opposed Hitler. Robert Scholl was never a fan of the Nazis, she writes, although he allowed his children to join the Nazi youth organizations. Hans joined the Hitler Youth and became a leader in it. However, his satisfaction with this organization would come to an end, though in the meantime, Hans and his father would often be at odds with each other. One of the turning points for Hans came in 1935, when Hitler himself, as well as Nazis from all over Germany, came to celebrate in Nuremberg, and Hans was picked to represent Ulm, picked by the Hitler Youth, you know, as the Hitler Youth representative from Ulm, or one of them. However, during his time there, it became clear, she writes, that the ideals of the Hitler Youth were not adhered to at all by the upper echelons of the organization, nor by the Nazis. See, now there's no explanation given for this. What is the writer talking about? How did it become clear? And how were the upper echelons not adhering to the ideals of the Hitler Youth? I think that's just bullshit. They just stuck that in there. She probably read that somewhere and stuck it in there, but, and they would have the idea that anyway, that Hans was becoming, disillusioned, but they have to have a reason for it, but they don't really give a reason. Now, but supposedly this was a big, the whole thing was a disappointment to Hans, the rally, and, because he had worked hard over the years, believing in these ideals, in spite of the fact that his father was opposed to them, so I have to kind of wonder about that. Then in 1936, he got into trouble in the Hitler Youth, as his troop had brought along a flag that they had made themselves with some sort of mythical beast on it and to which they had all sworn loyalty. Now, why would they bring a flag to a Nazi youth rally, a Hitler youth rally, with some mythical beast on it that wasn't in place of the swastika flag, and they had all sworn loyalty to this flag. Anyway, naturally, it says the Nazis did not like this. They demanded that the boy carrying the flag hand it over. The boy, who was just 12 years old, did not immediately hand it over. He was trying to be loyal to his troop and his flag, which he had sworn allegiance to. And Hans became upset by this, and punched the guy, she calls him the guy, who had demanded the flag. A fight nearly broke out, but a friend of Hans in the Hitler Youth, who outranked Hans, quickly took the flag, rolled it up, and took it home with him, trying to prevent Hans from getting into more trouble. But it says that Hans didn't let the story end there. He later went to his friend's house at night and broke a window in order to steal the flag back. This is not the way to behave, I tell you that. Something was going on with Hans. And anyway, for this, he was demoted, though he wasn't kicked out, since that would have meant he wouldn't have been able to finish school. So they didn't punish him so badly, but he was still in the Hitler Youth, but had been demoted for doing that. Now, at this time, he became interested in a different youth group called the DJ... 1.1 actually stands for Deutsche Jugendschaft Fund of November 1st, 1929. And it had emerged from another group, and it was founded by a young man named Eberhard Kubel, who went by the name of Tusk. And they, they based themselves a lot on the Hitler Youth, but they gave themselves more freedom. And the boys were taught that although they must listen to their leaders and work towards the good of all, they were also not to stop thinking for themselves. There was a love for other cultures in this other group, Deutsche Jugendschaft. And Tusk himself, the man who started it, had made journeys to Russia and Finland. Now, this was started in 1929, this group, and that were legendary for the members of his group. Also in this group, there were no books that were not to be read or songs that were not to be sung on the basis that they were not German enough. So they could read and sing anything they wanted. And Hans felt more and more of a draw to this group. And he and his friend, a friend of his, Ernst Reden, put together a chapter in Ulm, although it was forbidden to do so. And eventually he got called up for his obligatory military service. When he was away, his friend Ernst did not keep up with the group, so it fell apart, and people went their own way. So Hans kept up with many of his old friends, and the Gestapo, she says here that the Gestapo found this to be suspect. Anyway, whatever he was doing, he was arrested, and somewhere around this time, let's see, I don't know when it doesn't say. I can't think real fast, fast forward how old he would have been here, but maybe it was probably after Hitler was in power, sure, in the 30s. And he was arrested, and they came to the household, and they arrested his older sister and his sister Sophie, and brother Werner, but they didn't. Sophie was released immediately, but Eng and Werner were held for a week, it says, and Hans was held for a month. then Hans was able to convince the judge when his case came up that that most of what he had done, he had been doing some things that were wrong. I might have been part of this group he started, stuff like that. But he convinced the judge that it was just the impetuousness of youth, and that they hadn't been aware that he and his friends hadn't been aware that they were breaking the law. So, you know, he got reinstated to his Hitler Jugend unit again, I guess. So he got, he was now in the his obligatory military service, so he got reinstated back to that unit, which was semi-military. And by now, war had broken out, so already we're now in 1939. And Hans was again forced to be in the army. He was getting older now. He took part in the overtaking of France, which wasn't the worst place to be for him because he loved everything French. And he didn't have a hard time there. But in 1940, it was late in 1940 that Hans Scholl and Alexander Schmorell met each other. Well, I just want to make the point here, going through all this, is to show that Hans was already a dissident. He was already unhappy. Didn't like the kind of regimentation, I suppose, that was involved in National Socialism. Wanted more freedom and wanted to think, different ways and so on. So already he had problems with this. But in late 1940, he was pretty fixed in all this, and he met Alexander Schmorell through Jürgen Wittgenstein, or Wittgenstein. And Jürgen Wittgenstein is the one who's writing on the White Rose I read on Monday, or read a lot of it, took information from that. And they became fast friends and began working toward the objectives of the White Rose. It was not Hans' idea to get Sophie involved, but when she, a couple years later after him, when she came to the University of Munich as a biology and philosophy major, she learned what he was doing and she wanted to be a part of it. So he allowed her to do so. It says that Hans tried very hard to find other people to help in the cause of toppling the Nazi regime. He and Alex convinced a business partner of his father's, Eugen Rimminger, to donate money to help cover expenses incurred by their activities. Now, this is more evidence of his father's political activity and his father's friends, that they're all this way. On discovering that Lilo Ramdor, a friend of Alex's, was very good friends with the Harnack family, Hans endeavored to try to establish contact with others, whether it be the communists, whom the Harnacks were more involved with, or whether it was with the Donagni or the Bonhoeffers. Get that one right. It's another O-E. The Bonhoeffers, close relatives of the Harnacks, who were leaders in other resistance groups. So I don't know if I came upon this, if this is from her, web page, but it doesn't say it isn't, so it must be. But so here we've got, he's connecting himself up. He's being connected with the Harnack family, and the Harnack family were involved with the communists, and the Donagnis were traitors. They were involved also in the July 20th. Well, they were involved with who's the admiral who was the head of the secret, the spy, the security of the Reich. He was working with him. I can't think of his name. And with Bonhoeffer, the Lutheran minister who started going after National Socialism. He was a big traitor, too, actually, officially. I mean, he was very involved in all that, too. So here, his whole family is involved in this, and how he ever thought he wanted to be a Hitler Youth for some years when he was young, I don't know. Either it's sincere, and he wanted to go along with all his other friends. Maybe he didn't know that much at the time. And his father allowed him to do it because he didn't want to keep his kids from, because Sophie was in the Deutsche Bad Model too. So the girls' youth, and he didn't want to keep them from participating with their school friends and so on. Could be very innocent like that. Anyway, what I found out about these people is a little bit better than what I've said. Donyanyi was born in Berlin, Germany, to a jurist, and Christine Bonhoeffer. So they were the Donyanyis were related to the Bonhoeffers. And his uncle on his mother's side was Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a Lutheran, the Lutheran pastor. That's his first name, Dietrich. So that was his uncle. All right, we're talking about Hans' uncle was Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And his father, uncle, and other family members participated in the German resistance movement against Nazism. This comes from Wikipedia. And were arrested and detained in several concentration camps before being executed in 1945. And that includes his father, who also, I'm pretty sure I recall, he was executed in 1945. When Christoph, while we talk about Christoph here, was 15 years old. Oh, this is, okay, this is about Christoph. Sorry about this, but it's telling us about these people. This is another member of the group. So it wasn't Hans Scholl's uncle, who was Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I'm very sorry about that. But he was involving himself with these people, and another member of the group, Christoph Probst, was related to these people. And Donyanyi's older brother was a German politician and former mayor of Hamburg. Well, they were, you know, so there's a lot of politicians here. Anti-National Socialists, anti-Hitler politicians from the, no doubt, the Social Democrats, who were pushed out of power. Unfortunately, as he's continuing with this woman, just have this little bit left. Unfortunately, as these contacts were being developed, Hans and Sophie Scholl were caught at the University of Munich on 18 February 1943. So he was making these contacts towards the end, not in the very beginning. They were getting more and more contacts because they had already put out these six leaflets. And it says that he, Hans, Sophie, as well as Christoph Probst, were all executed at the same time, 3 days later after the Scholls were caught at the University of Munich. But okay, that's we'll get into that maybe a little bit. I talked about that some on Monday. Now let's go to Sophie Scholl as the second member. She wasn't the second member. Alexander, what's his darn name? Or Schmolin? Was the second member, but we're talking about her next, because she and Hans were executed together. They were the first ones to be executed. And this also gets into the family, you know. She had the same father and mother, so I don't need to repeat that. And there were she was the fourth of the six children, but the youngest, Hilde Scholl, only lived 1 year, or less than 1 year, or a little over 1 year, but anyway. So she died in 1926, shortly after she was born. And Werner Scholl, the fifth child, died, was missing in action in the war in 1944, presumed dead in June 1944. So Elizabeth Scholl, the third, married Sophie Scholl's long-term boyfriend, Fritz Hartnagel. So after Sophie was executed, I don't know how long after, but her 1 year older sister married her boyfriend, and then there was Hans, and then there was Eng, the eldest, who was a daughter. She died in 1998. So, and she was, you know, actively kind of talking and writing about them and so on, all that time. But Sophie Scholl was brought up a Lutheran, as would have been the rest of the family. She entered junior or grade school at the age of seven, learned easily, had a carefree childhood. They moved around a bit, and in 1932, she started attending a secondary school for girls. At the age of 12, she chose to join the Bund Deutscher Mädel. What am I saying here? Bund Deutscher Mädel, as did most of her classmates, but her initial enthusiasm, just like with her brother, gradually gave way to criticism. Well, naturally, if you come from a family where, you know, where your parents don't think that way, you're going to be influenced by your parents. I certainly was very much influenced by my father's political views and remained, you know, agreeing with that. I didn't have any problem, any reason not to, for a long, long time. And but it says that so she was aware of dissenting political views of her father and of friends and also some teachers, it says here. This is from kind of a Wikipedia page. Political attitude had become an essential criterion in her choice of friends. So she became very politically sensitive for such a young woman or girl. The rest of her brothers and friends in 1937, that early arrest for participating in the German youth movement, left a strong impression on her, which would have been very anti-National Socialist. And she liked drawing and painting and came into contact with a few of the so-called degenerate artists that had been labeled degenerate. And she was an avid reader and with an interest in philosophy and theology, but her firm Christian belief in God and in every human being's essential dignity formed her basis for resisting Nazi ideology. This belief was the foundation of her view of the world around her that fundamentally differed from the one expounded by National Socialism, which at the time of her death was the only view approved or allowed within the Nazi state, it says. In spring, although there are a lot of dissenters, but they couldn't officially form a party and run against the regime, the National Socialist regime. In spring 1940, the secondary school graduated her. All right, let's see. She became a kindergarten teacher, and then she thought that that might be alternate service to the Reichsarbeitsdienst, the National Labor Service. None of them wanted to go into this National Labor Service. Now, this was service for your country, but they thought it was too National Socialist, I guess, and they didn't like it, and they resented having to do it. And but she was not given credit for that there. So in 1941, she began a 6-month stint in the Auxiliary War Service as a nursery teacher. And so she had to spend 6 months working as a nursery teacher, kind of for free, although she got a room and board and stuff. And the military-like regimen of the labor service caused her to think very hard about the political situation, it says, and to begin practicing passive resistance. In other words, she was disloyal to what was the ruling system in her, the ruling regime in her country. After her 6 months in that service was up, she enrolled at the University of Munich. It was in May 42. And her brother Hans was there studying medicine. He introduced her to his friends. They were initially drawn together by a shared love of art, music, literature, philosophy, and theology, and also hiking, skiing, swimming, and so on. In Munich, Scholl met a number of artists, writers, and philosophers, particularly Karl Muff and Theodor Hecker, H-A-E-C-K-E-R. And this Theodor Hecker was a German writer, translator, and cultural critic. He was a translator into German of Kierkegaard and Cardinal Newman. He wrote an essay about Kierkegaard and about the philosophy of inwardness. And after that, he translated Newman's famous Grammar of Assent and became a Roman Catholic convert in April 1921. He's known for his consistent opposition to the Nazi regime, which took steps to silence him and his connections with the German resistance. So he was another serious Christian who became a cardinal in the Catholic Church. He's a Roman Catholic convert. His name is Newman. I wonder if he has any Jewish background. Who knows? I don't know. I didn't. It's not mentioned. It didn't. I didn't look. Try to find out. Just now occurred to me. But anyway, we know Cardinal Newman is famous, a famous man who people think his writings are just superb, and they were big influence on Sophie Scholl. And she says the question that this group of theirs, this group of students pondered the most was how the individual must act under a dictatorship. So they're talking mostly about ethics and honor and following your commitment to the religion that you believe in, so to speak, and not just lip service, but actually living it out. And it says that at this time in summer 1942, Scholl had to do more war service during the summer vacation from school. They all did at that time, I think, all university students, during their summer vacations, rather than just laying around, they or doing something else, they were required to work in their field, in something somewhere. I'm not saying they didn't get paid or anything, it wasn't forced labor or anything, but I guess it was kind of forced in their field to help the Reich, to help the war movement and all of that. And they always resented it. And it says at that same time, her father was serving time in prison for having made a critical remark to an employee about Hitler. Well, he was a serious dissident if they had put him in prison, because you could make critical remarks and nobody paid any attention, unless you were making a whole lot of noise about it, I guess. So, they're trying to minimize what he did here, but he must have been some kind of a ringleader. He was always involved in all these things and getting in trouble. So the Gestapo was watching him, and because they had reason to. So now back to this Cardinal Newman and Sophie Scholl's being influenced by him. It's based upon letters between her and her boyfriend, Fritz Hartnagel. He kind of got involved in it through being her boyfriend, or he became involved in it and then he became her boyfriend. I'm not sure, but he wasn't super involved in it because he wasn't around that much, but he's listed as one of the members. And these two people reported and analyzed these letters between Sophie Scholl and Fritz Hartnagel. And she says in there that, they take from there that she had given two volumes of Cardinal John Henry Newman's sermons to Hartnagel when he was deployed to the Eastern Front in May 1942. And they write that this discovery by Jacob Knob shows the importance of religion in Scholl's life and was highlighted in an article in the Catholic Herald in the UK. Now, I have that, and I was going to read it, but, boy, I'm naturally running out of time, so I don't know, because I need to talk about Alex Sherrill. So, but anyway, the White Rose was actually founded by Scholl, after Scholl and others, they must mean Hans Scholl, but read a stern anti-Nazi sermon by Clemens August Graf von Galen, the Roman Catholic Bishop of Munster. Although she was Lutheran, Scholl was very motivated by that. And both Hans and Sophie thought about turning changing to, converting to Catholicism. They seriously thought about it. They were attracted to it. I think a large part by this, the writings of Newman and a few others, and this von Galen, who was Catholic, a Catholic bishop. But in the end, they didn't do it. But they were really, they were what you would call very committed to their religious views and to their churches. Now, here's the thing. Here's the thing that they say. They always bring up that they had been horrified by Hartnoggles. This boyfriend of hers is the one who supposedly saw reported stuff from the Eastern Front to them. The behavior of the Germans on the Eastern Front, where Hartnoggle witnessed Soviet soldiers being shot in a pit and learned of the mass killings of Jews. Now, they never go beyond that. Now, why wouldn't there be Soviet soldiers being shot, you know, into a pit? Because lots of prisoners were executed because of things they were doing and atrocities they were doing. They very often caught them after they had committed all these atrocities on German soldiers. So I say, you know, what were the Soviet soldiers doing to the German soldiers? And why is there never any mention of this from these Great White Rose youngsters? You know, why are they so concerned with Russians and Jews, which they are, and Poles, but they're not concerned at all about Germans? They blame the Germans, the German soldiers, for what they're doing. And call on them to stop doing it. Well, this article at webarchive.org about the by Simon Caldwell, if you want to Google it, it's from the CatholicHerald.co.uk. The article is. And it's pretty interesting, but I've already pretty much covered all this, that Scholl was very much influenced by Cardinal Newman's writings, and they talk about how she felt compelled to live according to her convictions and how what she shared with this Hartnoggle, as to what he saw. And Hartnoggle wrote to Scholl from the front. And he was reading the books by Newman, and he quoted some of Newman's words in his letter, word for word, they say, and it is, "What a fallacy it is to take nature as our model for our actions and to describe its cruelty as great," Hartnoggle wrote in a letter in July 1942. So, you know, "But we know by whom we were created and that we stand in a relationship of moral obligation to our Creator. Conscience gives us the capacity to distinguish between good and evil." And so Mr. Knob, the writer here, identified Hartnoggle's words as being taken verbatim from Newman's sermon, and that Newman taught that conscience was an echo of the voice of God, enlightening each person to moral truth in concrete situations. So Christians had to act according to their conscience. And these youngsters were very, you know, impressed by this, as you can be when you're young and think, well, I better do it. And so they all tried to take their beliefs beyond just thinking and talking about it into action. It says that this Hartnoggle's conviction later led him to protest against the mass murders of the Jews. It's always the Jews were always being concerned with very much. We find that by these Christians. These Christians are very concerned with what's happening to the Jews. Although I have to say that there are all kinds of Christians in Germany who went along with what was happening and didn't, you know, understood why it had to be done and allowed it to be done, and we're not being alarmed by the kind of things that these White Rose members were being alarmed by. So, and then just here's where it says that Sophie and Hans had both asked to be received into the Catholic Church an hour before they were executed, but were dissuaded by their pastor, who told them it would upset their mother and they shouldn't do it. So now I got to get out of this. I need to go to Alexander Schmorell. He's very interesting, and I wanted to read this whole thing at www.pravoslavy.ru/English. Well, it's a Russian site, so it's all people who are, you know, pro-Russian and so on. But I don't think I'm going to just make a stab at it here. Alexander Schmorell was only 25 years old when he wrote a farewell letter to his parents from his death row cell in Munich Stadelheim prison. Well, you know, he's saying, "Dear father and mother, don't feel bad." You know, he's expressing all of his religious sentiments. "Divine will has me complete my earthly life." Oh, "has me complete my earthly life today." He was going to be executed that very day. "And to enter another, which shall never end, and where we will all once again meet." So this was his state of mind, you know, that we're going to find that his religion was first, and his religion was the Eastern Orthodox or Russian Orthodox. Maybe before I read this, I should go back to his childhood, and I don't want to go into too much detail about it, but as I said in the last show, he was Monday. He was born in Russia of a Russified German father, Hugo Schmorell, and a Russian mother who was the daughter of an Orthodox priest. And his mother, he was baptized, of course, into the Orthodox faith. His mother died from typhus when he was like only two. And his father remarried another woman who was also German, but she was also living in Russia. She was also Russian-German. And then and he got a Russian nanny who stayed for a long time. And he knew all his life, I guess, who he put in place of his mother rather than his stepmother more. You know, she was more like the mother to him, this Russian, total Russian woman. And in 1921, they emigrated to Germany. He was only about 4 years old, I believe, yeah. And so he was quite young. But even though he went to Germany when he was so young, he and his brothers and sisters, some of them were step siblings, continued to study Russian and read Russian literature and be taught about Russian traditions at home and so on. And Alexander loved his homeland, considered it his only true homeland. He wrote in one letter once, "No country will replace Russia for me, even if it is equally beautiful. No person is dearer to me than a Russian person." And he wrote, "I love Russia's endless steppes and breadth, the forests and mountains over which man has no dominion. I love Russians, everything Russian, which cannot be taken away, without which a person simply isn't the same. Their hearts and souls, which are impossible to grasp within the mind, can only be guessed at and sensed, which is their treasure, a treasure that can never be taken away." Well, see, there's nothing wrong with him loving Russia. He identified more as a Russian than as a German. And the problem is that he was a German citizen now, and he was from the time he was 4 years old, and the Germans, German nation expected him to think and behave and act like a German. But as we know, this doesn't happen with people. It's only a pretend thing that you can change who you are by going and living in another place and and taking on that citizenship. It doesn't change your heart and soul. And he had a Slavic soul and he had a love for that, and it never changed. So he's a questionable character in all this. Now, you know, so just like every other young man, you know, he decided to become go into medicine too. And like every other young man, he had to serve these things, you know, do this service in Germany. And he didn't like it. And he had to... He went ahead and made the oath to the Fuhrer out of necessity, but he, so that his family wouldn't be subject to peril. So he didn't mean it, you know, He was sent for a time to Austria, it says, where he... Now, listen to this. He was sent for a time to Austria, which had ostensibly, voluntarily united with Germany. You see, that's how these people write this stuff. Ostensibly, voluntarily united with Germany. And saw even clearer that the official propaganda and the reaction of common folk were diametrically opposite. Well, that is just not true. Not true at all, but you see what you want to see or else you just lie. I don't know. And he doesn't even say this, but somebody's writing it about him. And then during the invasion of the Sudetenland, they call it an invasion. It wasn't an invasion because the Sudetenland was German. He saw soldiers in Sudeten Germans treating the local Czechs as occupiers. Well, they were occupiers to the German minds, particularly by then. And so all this is understandable, but he didn't like it. And then he had to attend medical school. He went to medical school, and he had to do this two-year service. And he finally got into the university program. And that's where he met Hans Scholl. And we'll continue with this, and we'll have time to go into Hitler's ideas on Christianity and table talk also when we come back from the break. So stay tuned, I'll get myself reorganized here, and we'll have a good second half. See you then.
Yeah. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm looking for where I left off here. This is Carolyn Yeager with Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. We're talking about the White Rose Society. For some reason, here I am. Okay. And I don't want to waste any time with any more repeating of what's gone before. So I've got the same listeners and so on. So I want to say that in this long, very good essay about Alexander Schmorell, it says that his first wartime experience shook him to the depths of his soul and convinced him that he must fight fascism. You see? When you get with these Russians, they're always using that word fascism. That's the word they use for the Germans. Now, it said that, you know, then he discussed this with his friends, Christoph Probst. These were other medical students whom he had known since childhood, and Hans Scholl and Willy Graf. But it was Alexander and Hans who created the White Rose Group and wrote the first four leaflets. So they wrote and they spread these leaflets around, tells how they did that. And I talked about that before. Now, then he was assigned to go on the Eastern Front to a place in Russia, Gdansk. And he just loved that. He was so happy there. And he told his, he wrote to his friends about it. And when he got back When he was back in Germany, he wrote to Nellie, whom he had met there, girl he had met there, and said, "I do not feel at home here in Germany. I am drawn to my homeland. Only there in Russia can I feel at home." He promised Nellie that he would definitely return as soon as he completed his life's mission in Germany. Yet this was not to be. This is pretty sickening, you know, and I have to make an opinion here, that he's definitely working against the interests of Germany, but he thinks it's in the interests of mankind and certainly in the interests of his homeland, Russia, but also in the interests of higher, the higher order and God's will and so on. He doesn't seem to care what he does to Germany because he doesn't like it, but he... this is never brought out, it's never brought out these kinds of issues when they talk about these dissenters and these dissidents the people in the resistance in Germany during the war. So, they got Kurt. See, I can skip all this. Let's see here. Now, I don't... I'll let that go because I want to read that the leaflet that he wrote. So then Willy Graf was another one who was very devoted to his Roman Catholic faith. He was born, the usual stuff. And in 1929, he joined a Roman Catholic organization for children called the New Deutschland. And in 1933, he became a leader in this organization, and when Hitler came to power, restrictions were put on other youth, some of these youth organizations. They wanted everybody to be a part of the Hitler Youth, and everybody was joining there, but he wouldn't do it. He was very stubborn about it. He wasn't like the others. He refused to do it, and in 1934, he joined a Grauer Orden. It's mostly based on his Catholic beliefs and feelings. It's mostly based on that and probably that of maybe his family and the people in his family who felt that way too. And in 1936, there was a law that you could only join the Hitler Youth. I think there was something like that. And so he continued to participate in church and if I don't read all this, I can't figure out what to say, what I shouldn't say. But I'll just say that when he was ready to go to university. He was required to serve that usual 2 years, you know. So he served in Belgium and France, and then to Serbia, and in May to Poland. He was in Poland for 2 months, and then on to Russia. he wrote to his sister that. Let's see. Did he say anything here? Nothing. He just he doesn't write this, but somebody. Well, I'm not wasting time here. It's 1942. 3.13. Well, just make the comment that in January, February 1942, you know, 3.3 million Soviet soldiers, Soviet prisoners of war had been taken by the Germans. And these prisoners were kept in such terrible conditions that over 2 million of them died. Well, you know, they weren't. When you have 3.3 million prisoners, and these they started out with a million, you know, right off the bat. You're not prepared to feed and house all these people, and you know there was not much they could do but keep them in kind of bad conditions. Anyway, that's not the subject of the program. So the only thing is about Willy Graf is that I don't even know what it is anymore. I can't. I didn't bold anything in here for some reason, so I don't know what I'm looking at. Back in Willy Graf was as I said, he was arrested and executed along with Hans and Sophie, and that's what makes him so important, because he didn't do all that much, although he was supporting them, but he had one of the leaflet things in his pocket. And when they went and got him, he had this in his pocket and something that he had been working on. So that's how that's why they arrested him. That's why. No, it wasn't him. See, I'm confusing myself. I really apologize. I'm going to forget about Willy Graf now. He's kind of an interesting character, but it was Christoph Probst who was executed with the Scholes. And he was a married person at the time, and he didn't get all that involved. But he is the one that he had designed the 7th leaflet that was going to be put out, and he was carrying it with him Hans was carrying this with him when he and Sophie were arrested, and so it had some connection. They were able to connect it to this Christoph Probst, probably had his name involved with it or whatever, and so they arrested him, and that's that. And then a Catholic bishop of Munster, von Galen, he was a good man. He was a patriot. He was loyal to Germany. He, but of course he had to be loyal to the church too. And here's where you see the real break that comes in, the real conflict that comes in 1934. He had gone along pretty much. The church had gone along pretty much. They had the Reichskonkordat with the church, that the church would not be interfered with as long as they didn't interfere with the state. And so that was going along all right. But in 1934, Bishop von Galen began to attack the racial ideologies of the regime, and particularly critiquing the racial part of it, as published by Alfred Rosenberg. And he also declared it as unacceptable to refuse the Old Testament because of its Jewish authorship. So there again, you know, the Third Reich was trying to do something about the Jews and get the Jews not only out of the powerful positions in the country in business and industry, but get Jews out of the religion too, Jewishness out of the religion. But they resisted that. See, the church, both the Catholic, even the Catholic Church by that time resisted that and didn't, you know, thought that was going too far. Von Galen is known for his objection to the euthanasia program, which was 1941, and it was euthanasia and forced sterilization that were underway. And, you know, the euthanasia was not as bad as they want to make it out to be, because a lot of these people who were complaining, and some of them wrote to von Galen and complained that some family member of theirs had been murdered, you know, by the Nazis, who had been in an institution. Well, here you had these people who were not just mildly retarded or something like that, or even just retarded. They were incapacitated, you know, they were not functional. And there are all different kinds of problems that they had, but from insanity to a serious and a severe, physical problems. And so, they couldn't handle these people at home. You know, the family didn't take care of them. They gave them to the state, put them in these institutions. Then they expected the state to, spend millions of dollars, you know, Deutschmarks, taking care of these people. Because when you have people that are that bad off, they require, extreme care. They require a lot of personnel to look after them day and night. I mean, they require high level of care, and they're absolutely don't even know half the time that they're alive. So or who they are, or what they're all about. So they finally decided that the best thing was to euthanize some of these people and free up a lot of the caregivers for the soldiers of the war and so on. And but when these people got, and they got a message that their family member had died, and they sent them, I think they sent them the ashes in an urn, if they requested them, whatever, maybe they didn't even want them, but they tried to do it in a nice way, and they had a panel of three judges who all these cases had to come up to, you know, and they had to be approved. They weren't somebody on a minor level wasn't making, or somebody in the party was not making these decisions of, you know, who should be euthanized or who should be sterilized. So, but von Galen then made a big, big fuss about that. And, you know, this was an example of when the church and the, political establishment came into conflict, and Hitler did believe that they should have no say in the state, that they should attend to spiritual matters, and but they wouldn't do that, and so, but often Hitler backed down because he didn't want to seriously offend or get all the German Christians roused up, because he knew that Germany was a Christian nation. And he was not interfering with that, and didn't want to, even if he didn't particularly participate in it. But so that's where he was hoping to keep it, and we'll see that in some of the statements from Table Talks in just a minute. Now I'm to where I can read this leaflet, and I still have enough time to do it. So I want to read this. It's the third one. There were six that were distributed, or there were five and the six was ready to be, forget now already. But, let's see. What does it say here? Yeah, well, there were six that were written, and there was a seventh one that was in draft form. I don't think the sixth, that sixth one might have been the one they putting out in their suitcase when they got arrested. Hansen, Sophie. But this third one was written by, Alexander Schmorell, who I call the Russian, because he really was Russian. And I think it's pretty shocking what he wrote here. And if the word sabotage is used seven times in all, at least, and a lot of other things are said. So just to be calling on sabotaging the war effort and the industry and so on is pretty high crimes. So he writes, the leaflet says, sabotage in armament plants and war industries, sabotage at all gatherings, rallies, public ceremonies, and organizations of the National Socialist Party, obstruction of the smooth functioning of the war machine, sabotage in all the areas of science and scholarship which further the continuation of the war, whether in universities, technical schools, laboratories, research institutes, or technical bureaus. All ideal forms of government are utopias. That's true. A state cannot be constructed on a purely theoretical basis. Rather, it must grow and ripen in the way an individual human being matures. But we must not forget that at the starting point of every civilization, the state was already there in rudimentary form. The family is as old as man himself, and out of this initial bond, man, endowed with reason, created for himself a state founded on justice, whose highest law was the common good. The state should exist as a parallel to the divine order, and the highest of all utopias, the civitas dea, is the model which in the end should approximate. It should approximate. Here we will not pass judgment on the many possible forms of the state, democracy, constitutional monarchy, and so on. But one matter needs to be brought out clearly and unambiguously. Every individual human being has a claim to a useful and just state, a state which secures freedom of the individual as well as the good of the whole. For according to God's will, man is intended to pursue his natural goal, his earthly happiness, in self-reliance and self-chosen activity, freely and independently within the community of life and work of the nation. But our present state, in quotes, is the dictatorship of evil. Oh, we've known that for a long time, I hear you object, and it isn't necessary to bring that to our attention again. But I ask you, if you know that, why do you not bestir yourselves? Why do you not allow these men who are in power to rob? Why do you allow these men who are in power to rob you step by step, openly and in secret, of one domain of your rights after another, until one day nothing at all will be left but a mechanized state system presided over by criminals and drunks? So he's saying that the National Socialists are criminals and drunks. Is your spirit already so crushed by abuse that you forget it is your right, or rather your moral duty, to eliminate this system? But if a man no longer can summon the strength to demand his right, then it is absolutely certain that he will perish. We would deserve to be dispersed through the earth like dust before the wind if we do not muster our powers at this late hour and finally find the courage which up to now we have lacked. Do not hide your cowardice behind a cloak of expediency, for with every new day that you hesitate, failing to oppose this offspring of hell, your guilt, as in a parabolic curve, grows higher and higher. See, they weren't going to very easily reach the really common working people with these pamphlets, so I guess they weren't even trying to. And, you know, if they were writing for the right side, this, they say a lot of good things are said here, but it's absolutely turned around and being written about the wrong people. So it goes on, I don't know if I should read this whole long paragraph. I'm just looking for the kind of, at this point, should look for what is the most most treasonous. It says, the only one available is passive resistance. All right, he's using the term passive resistance. He's saying the only choice available is passive resistance. The meaning and the goal of passive resistance is to topple National Socialism. And in this struggle, we must not recoil from any course, any action, whatever its nature. At all points, we must oppose National Socialism wherever it is open to attack. We must soon bring this monster of a state to an end. A victory of fascist Germany in this war would have immeasurable, frightful consequences. Right? A victory of our nation would have immeasurable, frightful consequences. The military victory over Bolshevism dare not become the primary concern of the Germans. The defeat of the Nazis must unconditionally be the first order of business. The greater necessity of this latter requirement will be discussed in one of our forthcoming leaflets. And now every convinced opponent of National Socialism must ask himself how he can fight against the present state. State is always in sneer quotes. In the most effective way, how he can strike it for the most, strike it the most telling blows. Though passive resistance, through passive resistance, sorry, without a doubt, that's the answer. How he can strike the most telling blows through passive resistance without a doubt. We cannot provide each man with the blueprint for his acts. We can only suggest them in general terms, and he alone will find the way of achieving this end. Sabotage in armament plants and war industries. Sabotage of all gatherings, rallies, public ceremonies, and organizations of the National Socialist Party. Obstruction of the smooth functioning of the war machine, a machine for war that goes on solely to shore up and perpetuate the National Socialist Party and its dictatorship. Sabotage in all the areas of science and scholarship which further the continuation of the war, whether in universities, technical schools, laboratories, research institutes, or technical bureaus. Sabotage in all cultural institutions which could potentially enhance the prestige of the fascists among the people. Sabotage in all branches of the arts which have even the slightest dependence on National Socialism or render it service. Sabotage in all publications, all newspapers that are in the pay of the government and that defend its ideology and aid in disseminating the brown lie. Do not give a penny to public drives, even when they are conducted under the pretense of charity. You know, the ones for the poor folks. For this is only a disguise. In reality, the proceeds aid neither the Red Cross nor the needy. The government does not need this money. It is not financially interested in these money drives. After all, the presses run continuously to manufacture any desired amount of paper currency. Really? Huh? Oh, but the populace must be kept constantly under tension. The pressure of the bit must not be allowed to slacken. Do not contribute to the collections of metal, textiles, and the like. Try to convince all your acquaintances, including those in the lower social classes, of the senselessness of continuing, of the hopelessness of this war, of our spiritual and economic enslavement at the hands of the National Socialists, of the destruction of all moral and religious values, and urge them to passive resistance. He finishes up. Aristotle, in his Politics, writes, oh, I'm not going to read this. So he goes on and quotes Aristotle talking about tyrants and so on. And then he finishes by saying, please duplicate and distribute. That's leaflet number 3. And, you know, the others have, you know, bad stuff in them too. But this one of using sabotage all the time, calling on the German people to sabotage not only their government, but in a time of war, and their soldiers, and their military, you know, to cause defeat, seems pretty terrible to me. And it sounds exactly like the kind of propaganda that was coming from the Poles, you know, about the Poles were putting out to in the camps and so on, trying to sabotage everything in the camps. Sabotage any Polish person that had been given a position of responsibility and trust by the Germans was, you know, then encouraged to misuse that and to create as much sabotage as he could. So that's really treason, terrible kind of treason. And I don't think these young people can be excused because they are young and idealistic and so on. They came from that milieu, which not only wanted a lot of individual liberty and freedoms, wanted democracy, didn't like the way that National Socialism was trying to reinvent the German nation and strengthen the German nation and so on. And at the same time, they were all very Jew-friendly. And that's one of the things that you see running through it with every one of them, and with the adult friends and sponsors that they managed to gain. All were very upset about how the Jews were being treated. So by this time in their religion, in their Christian religion, they were not anti-Jewish. Not these people. Not at all. Now, I know that there are all kinds of different kind of Christians. And we all know the Christians who are, I'm going to turn to this now, we all know the Christians who are anti-Jewish, and there's a lot of them. And they're very sincere, and some of the Christians, and even some of the Christian identity people I know, are the most effective racially of all the people that I know. They are absolutely not just anti-Jewish, but totally pro-white, and they are uncompromising in that. And many who are not Christian are rather compromising about it. Then there are those who aren't Christian who are also uncompromising. So it's not the Christianity as much as it is how you view your Christianity, how you interpret your Christianity. But the fact is that the majority of Christians and the majority of churches today, almost all, interpret it as in that universalist way. And I have a problem with universalism in the idea that of a universalist God. Say that the Christians who will say will think of God as God of everyone, you know, and God is one God, therefore he's God over everyone. And therefore, the reasoning is that everyone is just as important to him. I mean, you know, the black African and the Asian and so on, and the Indian and so on are equal to God. He doesn't distinguish between them as we white people. So we don't have a God of our own in that respect. We're just one of the group, and God doesn't care about us. Our God, our only God, doesn't care about us any more than he cares about all these other people. So don't think you're special, and don't try to be special. And that's a very, very damaging, genocidal type of belief system. And yet it follows if you accept this God in the sense that they do. Now I want to talk about what Hitler has to say. And Hitler accepts the idea of God, absolutely he does, and of being the Almighty. But he doesn't go into any detail in table talk about how he lays that out, you know, and what God, you know, how you get to the racial idea. But I think he just sees that as I would, leaves it up to us. And we have every right to think along those lines and to have the benefit of providence, you might say, and let other people do the same. We don't have to decide who God is, if God is the God of every, what God thinks about people, because I don't even see God as that kind of an entity. And I don't think he did either. A lot of people don't, but they still believe in God, and they can even, I don't know if you can be Christian. See, because I'm not really anymore, so I don't know that. But I want to start out by saying that, you know, I've been very suspicious of table talk because as I said, I think in the beginning, I got the idea that many people are saying, have said and written about that the only English version of it was distorted by translators during the translation process. But mostly in the parts about Christianity to make Hitler appear more anti-Christian than he really was. And I believe this, but I must have been reading sites that were from Christians or else people who didn't want us to see Hitler as, as anti, who wanted us to see Hitler as a Christian, for one, either, you know, because they were Christian or for the opposite reason. I got information from the person who does the show, blogger website, and I don't know if I should use his name at this point, but I was talking to him about it, and he put me straight. He sent me. He's a translator, and he said he went through all the Christian passages, and that they were translated in the Trevor Roper so-called edition. Trevor Roper just wrote the introduction. He didn't do the translating. It was translated by Cameron and someone else. That there's nothing wrong with these. They're perfectly correct. And I just couldn't quite accept it. But I finally looked at David Irving wrote. And he's written that the notes that were typed originally by Heinrich Heine, whom David Irving says he interviewed, were genuine and highly reliable. And that, and this is what the other translations were taken from. Then there's the Henry Picker translation, the Henry Picker book, who he took over as Bormann's secretary and the taker of the notes while Hitler was speaking at the dinner table. And after Heim, for some reason, had to go somewhere else, couldn't do it anymore, and Henry Picker took over, and he started doing it. He also found a lot of Heim's notes in his desk and rewrote them in and published them in his own book of what he calls Hitler's Tischgespräche. And Irving says this is good but less reliable. So I'm just accepting this as what I had thought was, you know, was wrong, and that the main table talk, which is by Heinrich Heim, and I don't know if it's got Picker stuff added too. It must have some of it, but I don't know who all put it in there. It's very difficult to get a clear picture of this. It is for me, but I'm just taking it for granted. I'm just taking it now, accepting it now, until I find out differently that this English translation is all right, that it's accurate, and that the person who has supposedly messed it up was this Francois Genoux, who had purchased it from Bormann's widow, but he's the one who made up that Hitler's final testament that was a fraud, and so he puts him under a real cloud. But I guess he was okay. He was a Hitler fan, and he wrote that because he thought it would do a lot of good for Hitler's reputation or something. But to get on with this, so the English translation, according to David Irving, of the original Hitler's Table Talk was published in 1949 by George Wiedenfeld, an Austrian, who had paid a huge sum for the rights. He had to buy them from Genoud, and Genoud wanted him to pay half the money to him and half to Paula Hitler, Adolf Hitler's younger sister, and which I guess he did. Anyway, and then he had it translated. Wiedenfeld had it translated from the French, and by this Cameron and somebody else whose name I don't remember. And then Trevor Roper wrote an introduction to it and supposedly kind of edited it. See, I'm very suspicious of Trevor Roper. But supposedly, according to David Irving, but he's also English, he calls this the Wiedenfeld translation, because Wiedenfeld had it translated. And it's idiomatic and excellent. Being idiomatic is good, according to Irving, because that means it captures the way they actually spoke, you know, in their own idiom. And it's not stiff and wooden, you know, formal word-for-word type translation. So he says it's excellent. I'm going to have to go with that. And here are some things that Hitler wrote, starting on page 6, and remember, this is dinner table conversation. It's not public pronouncements that he wrote, thought over, and, you know, decided that, you know, was careful about it. He was supposedly aware that notes were being taken, and he said it would be all right. But then, you know, he was just talking and enjoying his, he enjoyed talking. He enjoyed expounding. And so he would do it for a couple hours or so, during dinner or after dinner. I think when they were actually eating, they were busy eating. And I think he was like that. You eat when you're time to eat, you eat, you don't talk and eat and let your food get cold. But then, you know, then they relaxed afterwards. And, the first thing that's, said about it on page 6 is, fundamentally, in everyone, there is the feeling for this Almighty, which we call God. And then supposedly added by Bormann, in parentheses, that is to say, the dominion of natural laws throughout the whole universe. That's how Bormann wanted that to be interpreted. But that absolutely sounds like Hitler, that, you know, he himself always had the feeling for the Almighty, and which everyone calls God. That's a reality. And then he says, in the long run, National Socialism and religion will no longer be able to exist together. And to a question from someone whether this antagonism might mean a war, I guess a war between National Socialism and religion, the Fuhrer continued, no, it does not mean a war. The ideal solution would be to leave the religions to devour themselves without persecutions. And this fits what he has said in other, you know, other times, other places, that he didn't want to take religion away. He didn't want to start a fight with the German people. He didn't want to start a big problem with the German people who were in large part devoted to their religion and their churches. And he knew that in the long run, and he may have meant a real long run, National Socialism and religion, you know, could not both be the dominant philosophy and belief system of the kind of nation that he wanted, that he was trying to build. You couldn't, they couldn't actually exist side by side equally. But his solution always was to leave religion alone and let it take care of itself. And when he uses the word devour, it sounds kind of ugly, you know, like, oh, now he's calling on religions to devour each other. No, he just means that they'll fight among themselves. And they do, you know. They try to get along. They seem to be trying even harder these days to get along in order to survive. But he thinks that, you know, religions... just they harm each other by their infighting and so on, and just let it happen that way. He took a long range view of this. Then he said the heaviest blow that ever struck humanity was the coming of Christianity. Bolshevism is Christianity's illegitimate child. Both are inventions of the Jew. The deliberate lie in the matter of religion was introduced into the world by Christianity. Well, first, you know, he's talking here about Christianity as an organization. You know, he's not talking about, you know, how people personally perceive it or whatever. He's saying that, or he's not talking about Christ. He's not talking about the original story of Christ and all of that. He's talking about the Christian church that was organized later, and he thinks that that was similar to Bolshevism. And he talks more about that later on. And he does say here that both are inventions of the Jew, the church, because he attributes it to Paul, who was the Jew Saul, and he's not a fan of Paul. So I think a lot of that is part of is behind what he's saying here. He denies that Jesus Christ was a Jew. Hitler does. He did. And he never changed that. And so for him, Jesus Christ is one thing, and the official entity of Christianity is another. And you have to remember that when you're reading this. So then he says, Christianity was the first creed in the world to exterminate its adversaries in the name of love. Its keynote is intolerance. That's a very popular one that's repeated a lot. But, you know, I don't know. What about Islam? They didn't exterminate out of love. They exterminated people, but not out of love. They are more honest about their desire to dominate. I think he's talking here about hypocrisy more than anything else. And without Christianity, we should not have had Islam, he said. The Roman Empire, under Germanic influence, would have developed in the direction of world domination, and humanity would not have extinguished 15 years of civilization at a single stroke. Let it not be said that Christianity brought man the life of the soul, for that evolution was in the natural order of things. The result of the collapse of the Roman Empire was a night that lasted for centuries. Well, he seems to be saying that if the Roman Empire had been allowed to continue under the Germanic influences that were coming in, and that there would have been, when he says world domination, you know, there would have been a more of a European government, a European power structure that would have dominated in the world. And that would have been more, you know, that would have brought more enlightenment to humanity, or better, you know, a better world to humanity than did the Christian, than what Christianity brought through all those years. And that therefore he sees the collapse of the Roman Empire as a bad thing. But he also says that the Roman Empire was taken over by the wrong forces. So it wasn't that good. But if it had been able to continue under Germanic influence is what he's saying, would have been good. So then he talks about the Jesuits, and here again he is saying that he said we should be grateful to the Jesuits because, but for them, for them, they helped us to abandon Gothic architecture for the light, airy, bright architecture of the Counter-Reformation. So he said, I don't quite understand this. It might not be translated all that well. In the face of Luther's efforts to lead an upper clergy that had acquired profane habits back to mysticism, the Jesuits restored to the world the joy of the senses. Well, you know, what's at bottom of this is that he doesn't like mysticism, and he doesn't like that, you know, heavily religious, what he calls dogma that doesn't take into account nature and science. And he likes nature, health, fitness, intelligence, and the modern, though not the kind of Jewish modernism that we have today. But he was very modern in his thinking and his likes, and he considered that what he was building architecturally in Germany, in the major cities in Germany, was of the modern variety and of that you know, where it's clean, light, and healthy. Now, he also said, on page 51, Christianity is a rebellion against natural law and a protest against nature. There again, you see, he's taking up for nature as against the mystical. I'm trying to think of another word for the mystical, but where you are too much dogmatism and ritual and too many things that are unnatural that you're supposed to believe. He says, taken to the logical extreme, Christianity would mean the systematic cultivation of human failure. Well, I like that as far as it's true, because there are things in Christianity that If you look at the communist side of it, the Bolshevik side of it, as he would call it, that is does the equality, the you know one world side of it, it does cultivate human failure, because the lowest becomes is more important than the highest. The highest has to serve the lowest, not you know, in absolutely the wrong way. Well, let's see now. I'm going to skip a little bit here, so I'll run out of time. Now, he thinks science is going to answer all the questions. Now, I know today we see that science has can take us in some bad directions. There's a lot of, among the religious, there's a lot of mistrust of science. Among those who like science, there's a lot of mistrust of religion. So, you know, that's kind of between that those two things too, you know, between science and the old mysticism. But he says it's not opportune to hurl ourselves now into a struggle with the churches. The best thing is to let Christianity die a natural death. For again, you know, that's what we already brought out before, and he repeats this kind of thing fairly often. Says the dogma of the Christianity gets worn away before the advances of science. So he thinks that, see, again, it's just going to be a natural progression, because as people become more educated and learn things, you know, are not under the domination of priests and don't have education, they continue to believe these things, but they won't continue. And that's been shown to be true. It says, gradually the myths crumble. All that's left to prove that in nature there's no frontier between the organic and the inorganic. He says, when understanding of the universe has become widespread, when the majority of men know that the stars are not sources of light, but worlds, perhaps inhabited worlds like ours, then the Christian doctrine will be convicted of absurdity. So he's just, you know, saying there that a lot of the things that Christianity has taught about the nature of the world and our place in the world and the universe and so on are absurd, and, you know, in light of discoveries of science, can't hold up. Well, this has been going on for a long time, and I think we've pretty well gone this path already. There's so many few Christians in the world today, and that's because they don't find the belief system to be something that helps them or appeals to them or that they can even believe in. And I think that's true. That doesn't mean that it's good that Christianity is becoming weak, because Christianity can be a bulwark against things that are much worse than it. But the whole point of it, when we get to the end of it, is that it's the attitude toward the Jews. You know, as long as Christianity cannot stand against Jews and the Old Testament and Judaism and so on, then it is weak. And so it's only that Christianity which does stand against that can be useful. And the thing with the Jews comes from the idea that it's a universalist, and that everybody is included in the love of God or something, and therefore is equal, and therefore you can't leave anybody out, and that includes Jews. Plus, of course, the problem with the Jews being even more special than everyone else. Let me see if I can find something really important here. He says, one may ask whether the disappearance of Christianity would entail the disappearance of belief in God. That's not to be desired. That's very clear. Where he dislikes atheism very much. He thinks atheism is an awful thing. Let's see as I go on here. He doesn't want the belief in God to be lost. He doesn't want our spirituality
to be lost. He wants us to be a spiritual people. But and he was himself, and he valued it very much. That's really obvious, very obvious. But he did have this opposition to the churches. And the churches were where the power was, because the people followed what their pastors and priests and bishops and so on told them. It was hard for them not to do so. So it was really the power of the religious establishment that he didn't like, because it opposed his power of his National Socialist
worldview and what he had built there. So that's basically where it is. But and if you can work through that, you can get through something. Now, you can get to the answers here. But on page 76, he said, originally Christianity is merely an incarnation of Bolshevism. This is, gets people going. And he said, Bolshevism, the destroyer. But then he said, nevertheless, the Galilean, who later was called the Christ, intended something quite different. He must be regarded as a popular leader who took up his position against Jewry. Galilee was a colony where the Romans had probably installed Gallic legionaries, and it's certain that Jesus was not a Jew. The Jews, by the way, regarded him as the son of a whore and a Roman soldier. The decisive falsification of Jesus' doctrine was the work of St. Paul. He gave himself to this work with subtlety and for purposes of personal exploitation. For the Galilean's object was to liberate his country from Jewish oppression. He set himself against Jewish capitalism, and that's why the Jews liquidated him. Now, that's pretty clear, and that is the way that Hitler was satisfied to look at it, as has been pointed out by someone like Bill Fink, who considers himself a biblical, not just biblical, but historical scholar of these times. Hitler just didn't have the knowledge to know any better than what he said. He disagrees about Paul, and a whole lot of Christians disagree. They're the anti-Paulists and the pro-Paulists, I guess. So Paul is that lightning figure there who divides people as to what his real intentions were and if he ever was a sincere follower of Christ, but Hitler makes clear that he thinks he's not going to criticize Christ, and he calls him the Galilean, and he doesn't want to think of him as Jewish, and I think he sincerely thought he couldn't possibly be Jewish because of the way he was, the way he spoke, and so on, and so he accepts this explanation for it. And he would like people, the Christians, to accept it too, but they don't all do so. So that there you have, continue to have the problem. See, I think, I wrote it here in a better way, but I said it in a not so good way. So I'll just leave it at that. It's striking to observe that Christian ideas, despite all St. Paul's efforts, had no success in Athens. Well, then he goes on to talk about the Greeks, and he talks more about the Romans. And I agree, I don't know if he knows, if he's an expert in all that, but that's... he says, though, the Ten Commandments are a code of living to which there's no refutation. These precepts correspond to irrefragable needs of the human soul. And so he stands up for things like the Ten Commandments, which actually are in the Old Testament. But... then he talks about Carol, who was the man in the Third Reich who was the one who was trying to bring National Socialism and Christianity together into a national German National Christian Church. Anyway, he had a position in the government to do that. There were some others who were involved in that. But he was kind of the the main National Socialist Christian who was working with the government. And Hitler speaks well of Carol for wanting to create a synthesis between National Socialism and Christianity. But then he says, I don't believe the thing's possible, and I see the obstacle in Christianity himself. So he did support it in real life there, and he did try to help it, you know, get to win over all the people, and a lot of Germans were going along with it. But in the end, there were church people who refused to do so, and they were able to stop it, to keep it from passing and becoming a reality. And so, and this is what Hitler, while he put himself behind it, he probably didn't, he says he never really gave it much of a chance, gave it a chance anyway. Boy, you know, as usual, I can't get through all this. So what we see, if I can sum up just a little bit in what I think, is that I think it's pretty hard. I think when Hitler said that eventually Christianity and National Socialism will not be able to stand together, then you might say that, well, Christianity has already won and National Socialism has lost, which is a shame, because the fact that Christianity cannot tolerate what National Socialism stood for is an indictment against it. And even though there are those Christians who agree with that, you know, and stand with Hitler in that position, you know, they cannot, I guess, bring a change in Christianity itself. And so I'm going to have to leave it at that, folks. Thanks for listening, and come back on Monday. Maybe I'll be on this same topic. See you then.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.